This is Mike Valentine from the Strobance Cardiovascular Center at Centra in Lynchburg, Virginia, and currently incoming president of the American College of Cardiology. I'll be your host for the podcast series, Practice Made Perfect, a new featuring with in-depth conversations with experts on topics related to career and leadership development necessary for young cardiovascular professionals to succeed in the changing healthcare landscape. Join us as we explore these critical subjects of non-clinical competencies in the weeks to come. Today, we are joined by Dr. Pam Douglas, MACC, a past president of the American College, and a faculty member at Duke University who has extensive training in job search for her fellows over many years. Pam?
Thank you, Mike. It's a pleasure to be here. I actually ran our fellowship program at the University of Pennsylvania 18 months after I finished fellowship, so I've been at this for a while and hopefully have some insights to share today.
So today on Practice Made Perfect, we're going to speak about how to find a job. And I have been a member of a small private practice and then a medium-sized healthcare integrated system. And Pam, as just noted, has been in an academic center for over 25 years and has great experience in these. We're going to share this topic and try to bring together many different opinions and ideas for you in your job search in the coming years. We'd like to start with a couple of things about basics and overview of the process. Pam, I'd like you to give us an overall outline of what we're going to be speaking about today for the next 15 minutes so our listeners will be able to plan their time when they're listening to this podcast.
We're planning on covering about 10 topics here today. First, an overview of the process, then something on the landscape of what jobs are out there. Then we're going to drill down for each of you on how to conduct your own search, your timeline and priorities at each stage. Then we're going to talk about how to find opportunities and make connections with potential employers. Turn to the interview process, how to prepare for it, what to do during the interview. Once you have an offer, how to negotiate that. How to seal the deal with contracts and offer letters. We're going to touch on some special considerations. And then finally, at the end, we're going to give you a top 10 take-home points.
I think it's important that you, listening to us, understand that Pam has an incredible background in academic medicine, and mine is in private and integrated, and so we'll share different points for each, although many of the things that we advise you today apply to everyone and will not be specific to what type of job you're looking for, but some general overall considerations. So we also want you to know that our talk today and our podcast is accompanied by two very nice slide sets that the college has. And so you'll have all the background information to go over, and you don't have to write down everything that you find in here because we have it well outlined for you. And it's important now that you listen to the main considerations and get the overall gist of what we're trying to say and impart to you today for your job search.
So let's kick it off. How to plan for your post-fellowship life and career. That's very important. I very intentionally put both of them together because in choosing a job, you are choosing your post-fellowship life. You're choosing a location, you're choosing a lifestyle, you're choosing the intensity of your work, you're choosing the people that you're going to spend most of your waking hours with. I feel strongly that the planning process begins at the beginning of your fellowship, and you really need to start thinking early on about the type of job that you want, whether you want an academic job, a private practice job, employed physician, industry, consultant. There's a whole range of different opportunities available to you as a cardiologist that really changes the texture of what you do. Also know that as medicine changes, the job descriptions and opportunities change, and we'll talk about the landscape in a little bit. But the most important thing going into a changing world is to know about what you want from your career and from your life and what your family and significant other or spouse wants, because they are your partner in your life.
I think it's important, Pam, to note that 10 years ago, this was dramatically different. The academic career was a completely different pathway than the integrated or private practice because there were no integrated practices. And so I would say now that many of our listeners are going to say, well, what's the difference between an academic or an integrated job? And I will tell you that in my integrated practice, you can do research, you can do teaching, you can do administrative time, you can do all of these things in a similar way, but it's in a different type of institution than you work at, Pam. But I want our listeners to know that just because you may want to do clinical research doesn't limit you or mean that you just have to have an academic job. So the job descriptions have changed dramatically in the last 10 years. Is that what you've seen?
Yes, absolutely. And I think part of that is that they've changed it on both sides of the street, if you will, that academics has become more flexible and it is possible to have a very viable and successful academic career as a master clinician in an academic institution where you participate in clinical research, possibly being a site PA, maybe referring patients, but are not required to get grants, don't have a huge amount of time dedicated to that, but are expected to build practices, build relationships with the community, build referral sources that based on unique expertise in an academic center, as well as the traditional 80-20 researcher who is on soft money for salary and expected to publish intensively.
Right, and as we said in the integrated opportunities now, if you're interested in clinical research, it's important that you seek that out in the practices that you may be looking at or in the health systems you look at, that if that's important to you and yet you don't want to go the complete academic route, it's important that you keep that as a list of the things that you're looking for in those institutions. So Pam, you were talking about trying to drill down into the timeline of your search, and you talked about how important it is to start early. So tell me, if you had a 3 to 4 year fellowship program, how would you start looking at years 1 and 2 into what you would start advising your fellows to do?
So I'd start by defining your career goals. You know, think about a subspecialty within cardiology if that's what you want to do. Think about what your job description is, and I don't mean in detail, but do you want to spend time at the bench? Do you want to, you know, be a high volume interventionalist? These sorts of things in the first couple of years as you're going through your initial clinical rotations are the kinds of things that should be rattling around your brain, and you should be focusing your training and your electives to achieve those goals. I would also start early on in those first 2 years on critically reviewing and revising your CV, because that is your calling card and that is what people will see and remember you for. So make sure that it is, you know, perfect. Make sure that any gaps in leadership, you know, if you're running a fellows conference, for example, make sure that's on your CV. If you're participating in a research study in a meaningful way, it's okay as a trainee to put that on there, even though it's not a publication, so long as you're transparent about your participation or work in progress. Start thinking about a wish list. Start making some connections both within your program and outside your program. Again, depending upon where you think you're headed, make connections with people at other academic institutions or perhaps in a large group or in specialty practices.
So Pam, one of the questions that I'm commonly asked now by fellows at all of these national conferences is, what should I be expanding my training to in years 3 and 4? Should I do an extra year in imaging? Should I do EP? They all want to know this because they're all paranoid about the job market and what would make them most marketable. So what do you advise years 1 and 2 when they're saying, Pam, should I super specialize or should I stay a general cardiologist? Where are my best opportunities in 2018?
That's a fabulous question, and it's not an easy one to answer because there's a sweet spot between what your interests are, because you will always do better at things that you're interested in, what your skills are, if you don't have manual skills, don't be interested in cath, and what the opportunities are in the program or practice that you end up in. And so it's all of the above. In most cases, I would say at least 50% of the time, maybe more, and Mike, it'd be interesting to know your thoughts, it's a location-specific or practice-specific opportunity. They just lost an electrophysiologist, or somebody started an AFib program and it's going crazy, and so they need somebody else to help on that. those kinds of turnovers happen a little bit more in academics than they do in practice, but it's still a very, very local needs-based thing. One approach to this is to be relatively general, focus on your interests, but make sure when you interview that you can say to people, you know, I have 9 more months to go in my fellowship program, or 1.5 years to go in my fellowship program. I'd like to get some extra skills and training that would make me more valuable to the practice, maybe expand my area of interest. You know, what do you guys think about that? Is that something that would be attractive to you? And that becomes then a negotiating position that you can not only bring what you have already done, but what you will do in the future, that additional expertise.
Yes, so I've just decided to hire you based on that comment there, Pam, because that's wonderful. I see a lot of our fellows trying to make critical decisions in an early time that may be a mistake. And so many years ago, if you remember, Pam, the big thing was coronary CTA. Everybody was going to get training in CT, coronary CT, because they thought that the explosion in CT was going to affect so many of them. And yet what we found out, that regulatory and payment issues became a barrier to them. So I agree with you, Pam. I think they need to find out where their passion is, and they don't need to let the future potential for job totally drive what they do. Because if you're a non-invasive cardiologist and that's what you love and that's what you love to do, you're going to be far more successful. I've also seen some of them super specialized to a degree that actually limits their job opportunities. Those now that are looking at structural may limit themselves to a certain number of programs that are looking for a structuralist in the next 2 years. So you need to think about that before you decide to super specialize, that you may actually be limiting some of your job choices moving forward, both for integrated and academic.
And the other thing is it's going to change. So every 5 years, something new, you know, comes down the pike and there's new skills that are needed. And so what might be a really hot ticket in 2018 might be less exciting, you know, in 2025. But it's really a simultaneous equation, and there's no single right answer.
Okay, so then Pam, we've talked about years 1 and 2. Jump to years 3 and 4 and tell me where you're thinking and advising your fellows. What should they be doing in those latter years when they've done the basics that you've already recommended?
So wind up those basics, really get ready. And this is a time to make 100% sure your family is on board, to start talking about locations. More and more people are in two-career couples, have families that raise children, may have personal special needs, or their children may have special needs. Start scouting out what that means to you in terms of what opportunities you can look at. And then the next thing, wind that up quickly, because I think about 18 months before, you know, July 1st, job day one, you really need to have good idea of what you want to do. You need to be making contacts with people. We'll talk about that, finding possible positions, making sure that you have materials ready for a really good first impression. That's your cover letter and your CV and your correspondence with people. And then the interview process should start 12 months out, I think. If some people start before, but if you're 12 months out and you are not ready to go with contacts and a job description and everything, you're a little bit behind.
Yes, we've recommended that most of those who have joined us have joined in the fall before starting the next summer, July or August. And so we're really looking in the hiring process of making early interviews in late summer, early fall, and often closing the deal in late fall, early winter, because you want to give them time to prepare for that move and the things that they're going to need to do. And as you said, potentially some additional training or changing training, which makes you very flexible and very valuable to me. One of my partners did 6 months of high-level imaging, their last 6 months of training, and were able to negotiate that in their training program because they signed with us in September.
In academics, it's a little bit slower. I think people are really signing more typically in the winter than in September, but really getting started in the summer is the time.
Okay, Pam, one of the things that our listeners are going to want is, how do they find the opportunities and connections? And I know we've listed those in our slides, but just real briefly, tell me about how you would make the connections in that job search for where you want to go and where you want to be. And
so the more that you know what you want to do, the easier it is to make some connections. Because if you say, I want to be a general cardiologist anywhere in the country, in a medium to large size practice, that doesn't really help you. But if you say, you know, my family is in Oklahoma, and then I want to be near my family or within a 6-hour drive of my family, get out the map, draw the circle, right? Mm-hmm. Figure out what the programs and practices or academic centers are that are 6 hours within your target position. Or maybe your spouse has a job or would like to have a job, you know, also finishing school or training and going somewhere. Then start reaching out to these people. In academics, the fall meetings are fabulous times to connect with people. ACC is usually a little early because it's in the spring, but the fall meetings, HFSA, ASNIC are usually in September, TCT is September, October, AHA is November. Those meetings should be job hunting meetings for you. And a TCT probably a little bit more effective for the private practice groups than AHA for the academic folks. But make those connections. Send letters. Send a beautiful cover letter and a CV that's very respectful, that has no typos in it, that says, I would like 10 minutes of your time. Can we please chat? And then follow it up with a phone call to their office, to their secretary, to schedule those 10 minutes. Or say, can I have coffee with you, or can I walk you at the AHA meeting? Can I walk you from your 10 o'clock lecture to your 10:30 lecture? Can I walk with you and chat? So there's a face with a name, and it's really personal. So that's reaching out to employers. Also reach out to peers. Your colleagues who've gone the years before you in terms of fellowship, many of them have gone to other places. They know what's in their local environment. They can provide you with an incredible recommendation to join their practices or practices that they may be aware of. You yourself may well have trained elsewhere before your fellowship or have experiences doing clerkships or something elsewhere. Those connections are fabulous.
So I'm going to jump to the ACC as president of the ACC in 2 weeks and say, Pam, how about cardiology careers, which comes on our website on acc.org. I'm also going to be very proud of our chapters. Our chapters hold job fairs for many of our FITs, and recently on the Board of Governors blog, we found over 20 different chapters that hold major job fairs and helping to teach these non-clinical competencies to our fellows, which the college is really starting to do now. We're revving up our game in this to teach our fellows all of these tactics. So I would ask them to also use the ACC as a resource in cardiology careers, online in JACC, and as well looking to your chapter governor and your chapter council to help you in this process.
Great points.
So one last thing before we start jumping to interview, Pam, let's talk about those that may want to assist our fellows in the job search, those who would be called headhunters or consultants who would want to sign you up to a contract to help you look for a job. Any advice there?
I think that is basically a no-fly zone for anybody interested in academics. It's kind of a red flag, and I'll leave it to you to talk about the community world.
Well, it's been pretty tough on us in the integrated model because those consultants are going to require $25,000 to $35,000 from the practice when they sign immediately. And so I would discourage initially looking for that unless you're having trouble finding that job and really think that you're going to need a third party to help you. We much prefer those who reach out to our practice directly, and we have encouraged that. Again, the opportunities of using the college as a conduit and using the leadership in the college to help you in that search, to me, is really a first or second line approach before you go to the consultant to help you find that position. All right, now, Pam, I'd like to jump the ship. Our listeners have circled the zone that they want to live in. They've chosen their subspecialty or their general cardiology or their imaging, and now they're looking to the interview process. Give me some tips when I start interview. What do I need to start thinking of before I get to that first interview? Give me 3 or 4 tips of what I should be thinking.
So, Mike, that's exactly right, that you do not go into an interview unprepared. This may be one of the most important few hours of your life, in fact, because this will determine your job. So the first thing is congratulations, you got the interview. Spend a lot of time gathering information, everything that you can, and make sure you process it. Make sure you know who you're meeting with, and make sure you know something about them to talk with them about their work. This is just like dating, right? Everybody wants to talk about themselves. Also, if you're applying in academics and you're being asked to give a talk, make sure that talk is beautiful. Make sure your slides are beautiful. Make sure you've practiced it beforehand. There's a whole literature on giving talks to your dog, making your dog sit down and listen to you give a lecture. When you're at the interview, you are your own best advocate. So you need to be able to articulate subtly and with humility what you have to offer this program and this job and this institution, both professionally and personally, because that's what they're looking to find out from you. What you need to do is find out what that program can offer you, and that's your information gathering time. Be ready with questions. The worst thing to do is when you sit down and interview with somebody and there's a little few minutes of chit-chat and then somebody turns to you, say, what do you want to know about the program? And then you've got 42 minutes out of a 45-minute interview to fill with your question. So be prepared.
Pam, those are great points, and I would even add to it, a lot of our fellows are going to say, okay, in the first interview, should I talk about money, should I talk about call, all those kind of things. And I stress that the worst thing you could do is come out of the gun with, well, how much am I going to make, what is my call schedule going to be. I think that you should be offering flexibility, showing your strengths. You're really trying to sell yourself at first. And when you're asking questions in that first interview, your questions should be about the practice and the quality and the culture, and so that you can learn more and more and more. I think, Pam, if I were interviewing you, it would be a red flag to me if you started talking about money and call and how much am I going to have to work and things like that right out of the bat. Would you agree?
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, that would be full on. Let's just stop right here. Because you're talking about a lifelong relationship potentially, and so you want to know what they're about. And quite frankly, we are so lucky in cardiology that we are compensated well compared to the rest of the medical world, even not even the rest of the universe, that if you're in a place that you feel valued, that you love your colleagues and you're passionate about your work, a little bit of money doesn't really matter that much in the long run to have those other things. They're much more important priorities. We're not ever worried about a living wage here in cardiology, and we're lucky about that. So I make sure that on the first interview that I tell my fellows, make sure you know the opportunities, make sure you know the drawbacks. Do you and the job have similar goals for you and for the practice of division, and the definitions of success, are they the same and do you share them? Because if you don't share those fundamental values, in the long run, all the negotiations about everything else are not going to fix that. Will you grow professionally in this job? Will you and your family be happy there in 5 years or 10 years? And then my own personal best question is, when you leave at the end of the day, are you exhausted or are you so excited you can't wait?
Excellent. I couldn't have said it better. And those are such great critical pearls that you've given me. And I would say, do not come out of the gate asking about call and money and things like this, because those details can come later. You want to find about a culture and quality. And is this a family that you want to be a part of? To me, that's what I want you to be seeking when you do.
So not only that, but most places have standards for call and all that other stuff. And you don't want to be seen as bucking the team.
Right.
If there's a practice of 20 cardiologists, and they have all agreed on this call schedule and this compensation model, you coming into that practice are not going to change that.
Right.
And so whatever your desires and interests are, it should be to be a member of the team and to be a part of that group consensus process rather than to say, I want or I need.
And I stress flexibility when you come in, saying, I am open to doing this. I would be very happy to do this. So be open and suggestive. All right, Pam, we're going to jump past the interview. I have just started to talk about offering you a job, and here's now it's going to get down to. So give me just some basics, because a lot of these things are difficult to put together here in a short time. But give me some scope on what I should be thinking about in negotiation.
So in spite of what I just said about call schedules being set by the group, I would say that everything is negotiable. And that doesn't mean that every detail of every offer is negotiable, but it means that every job has some scope in it, some scope offer to find some common ground on things that are valuable to you and things that are valuable to the practice. And approaching the negotiation process is like you would any negotiation process. You've spent a couple of years thinking about what you want and what you need, and you've decided that you can get much of that with the practice. What you need to start in the negotiation process is to turn the tables 180 degrees. What is it that practice or that academic center, what do they want? Because the more that you can deliver of what they want in the negotiation, the more they will be able to deliver what you want to you. So what do you have to offer? What do they have to offer? If the pie isn't big enough there, can you expand the pie? So if they say, well, we need you to be in outreach 2 days a week, and then the other 3 days a week you can do X, Y, Z, you can say, fine, I'll be in outreach 2 days a week, but of the other days a week, I need this level of support in either my research or my clinical enterprise so that I can make the most of that 60% time. And instead of having 80% time at the mothership, I'm only going to have 60%, but I'm going to have support systems that's going to make that 60 be even more productive than the 80.
So I had a fellow yesterday approach me and say that his negotiations for the job offers he had were significantly impacted by his activity and involvement with the ACC and his leadership and what he had done through the Early Career Council and FIT Council. Wise advice, Pam. Would you advise those to get involved? Because their skill set helps them negotiate better.
So almost everybody coming out of the fellowship program is well-trained in the United States. So what's going to be differentiating? You're going to be an interventionist. You know how to do interventions. You don't have a quality score yet coming out. I mean, you can't say, I am a five-star interventionist and I'm two standard deviations, you know, below the national average in complications. You can't say that yet. But you can say, I have personal skills. I work well in a team. I know how to conduct a team. I have leadership skills. I have emotional intelligence. And how do you demonstrate that? If you've been on a committee, if you've been tapped for a national position, if you've got a leadership role in your chapter, maybe you're running the FIT program in your chapter, you're demonstrating those, what we call non-clinical competencies or professional skills. You're demonstrating that in black and white on your CV. And those are things that you can talk to people about over dinner, for example, at a practice, which is a great way to connect on a personal level.
Sage advice. Thank you for that. Now, I'm just going to ask you one question about this, because this is covered in another of our podcasts on contracts, because everybody needs to understand contracts, which is coming to you from us. But just one question, Pam. Do I need to hire an attorney?
So in academics, no. That's just really not done. If you have concerns about something like a non-compete, you might ask about that. Most academic programs, and obviously each one is different, has a text offer letter that you sign and send back, as opposed to a formal legal contract. Now, the practice world, the community world may be different.
Practice world is a little bit different, and I would advise, especially if there are any questions, that it never hurts to run your contract by an attorney before and have them look over areas because of special things that you mentioned, like non-compete clauses, things like this that may impact your life if you're not happy with this new family.
And your employer doesn't need to know.
Right.
Actually.
So I'm going to jump to one thing that you have mentioned before, Pam, which is special considerations when they're in the negotiation and everything. Just give us three or four things that they should be thinking about.
Being a woman in cardiology, I get asked by women a lot, but I think the issue is equally true for men and women, and it's the work-life balance issue. It's the two-body problem, if you will, that increasingly both partners are working outside the home and are seeking to have not just employment, but real careers, so real engagement. And that becomes very important in a job search. Most academic programs will work hard to find a couple placement, even outside in the community. And it's not too much to ask to say, you know, my partner does XYZ, not medical, you know, help connect me with resources in the community so they could find a position. That's totally fair to do. You can also say, you know, we have a family and we have children. And most cardiology programs are not too keen on flexibility, particularly for people entering. But there are ways to find that in a job description that are unique to the person and to the program. And I would urge you to be thinking about those things going into the process.
All right, Pam, I'm going to ask you to close with your top five recommendations, and then I'll follow up on a few extras. But if you were going to give a take-home message to whoever's listening to this, the five things they need to write down out of this, what would you advise?
Well, number one, start early and be proactive. Two, think broadly and consult broadly. Get a lot of advice, get a lot of help. Three, most opportunities are created. They don't come to you, you find them. Fourth, we haven't talked too much about negotiations, but everything is negotiable in terms of a job. So there are always sort of special deals. It may not be the core of how many days in the cath lab and how much call, but there may be other things that are negotiable that are important to you. And I finally would say, enjoy the process. It's a remarkable opportunity over a year to learn about other programs, to meet colleagues in other institutions and in other practices who can become lifelong friends and connections, and enjoy that process rather than being anxious about finding something at the end. You will find something at the end, and it will be awesome.
Pam, that's wonderful. I would just add to that that, number one, when you're looking at any job opportunity, academic, integrated, or private, that culture trumps everything. You are looking at a new family, and the culture of that family is important. You will spend so much time with them that that must be your primary initiative. Number two, flexibility is your friend. Saying, yes, I'll go to outreach clinics. Yes, I'll do general call. Yes, I'll do these things makes you much more valuable. Third, stress your strengths. Tell them the things that you're good at, the extra qualities that you have that make you a valuable partner. Because everyone, no matter in what job setting, is looking for their next partner, not just an employee. And finally, I would say, brush up on the non-clinical competencies that we're teaching here. Listen to the podcasts that we're developing for you. Look at the amount of opportunity that the college is going to give you in training, not only in emotional quotient, but business, leadership opportunities, and develop those extra skills that will make you stand out from the pack. So this is Mike Valentine. I'm joined today by Pam Douglas, one of my close friends and mentors for many years, host of the podcast series Practice Made Perfect. Thanks for joining us today. Please also join us online at acc.org or wherever you get your podcasts, where you can find all the other episodes in this series. In addition, acc.org has additional tools and resources such as slides and articles that accompany us today and which will help you navigate these complicated topics. Pam, thank you for joining us.
A pleasure, Mike.